This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Jonathan Schanzer, Executive Director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, to help me understand the headlines pouring in from Israel about the war in Gaza, the war in Lebanon, the war in Syria, and the war with Yemen and Iran. We begin with headlines. Security Cabinet to discuss Gaza fighting hostages today, this afternoon. That would be Israeli time, as large protests take place. Jonathan, a very good day to you. The protests first. I see that there have been large demonstrations again these last days against the Netanyahu government. This is, I'm told, natural after a long time in office, not a threat. And the protests seem to have different agendas, but one of them is the hostages. So let's begin with the hostages. The number I have is that there are 20 living hostages, and two of them are in extremely poor health. Is that accurate? And where is the negotiation for the hostages? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yes, the current news out of Israel for the last two or three days is that two out of the living 20 hostages are in poor health. Their specific conditions have not been released, nor have their names. But we now understand this to be the case. Donald Trump actually indicated that that perhaps one of them or two of them may not be alive in offhand comments that he made. That's since been clarified that they are still alive, but in poor health. Meanwhile, the Qataris right now are pointing fingers at the Israelis, saying that they have not yet responded to the latest deal on the table, as if to say that Israel is responsible for the suffering of these hostages, even as the Qataris host the top leaders of Hamas, who have been refusing to release those hostages now for the better part of 2 years. The deal on the table is the same deal that we have now seen multiple times: partial return of hostages, both living and dead, over the course of several exchanges. And that would be connected to a 60-day ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. This is not something that Netanyahu necessarily needs or wants right now, as he considers an offensive that would conquer Gaza City and perhaps vanquish Hamas. We're hearing right now from Donald Trump that he believes that if Israel launches this offensive, that it could end the crisis within 2 to 3 weeks. I think that may be a rosy prognosis for Gaza. Nevertheless, it does appear that plans are being put in place. What's not clear to me, John, is whether Bibi is using the threat of an offensive in Gaza as a means to put pressure on Hamas, or whether he has just determined that this is what is necessary, that it's a foregone conclusion, that a military solution, so to speak, is the only solution to this standoff in the Gaza Strip. But I do think that the protests in Israel are heating up. The political debate in Israel is also heating up. One gets a sense that the Israelis have truly tired of this war. The international community obviously has also tired of this war, and so we may begin to see an end game. It will not be easy for Israel to execute on this end game, given the amount of pressure that has been placed on this country from the international media, from the international community, from the domestic population in Israel. All of these things will make the choices for Netanyahu more difficult as he considers military action here at the end. But nevertheless, it does appear that an endgame may be taking shape.
I'm told that Gaza City is an oasis in the midst of anarchy, that there are shops filled with food and other paraphernalia, that people live on as if the war was not going on a mile to the south, and that directing an offensive against Gaza City is extremely complicated given the way the population is condensed there. Is that accurate, John?
That is accurate. We understand that there's somewhere between 700,000 and a million people in Gaza City. Most of the buildings there remain intact. It is still a functioning metropolis, more or less. And so when Israel says that it's going to go in and begin to root out Hamas, it will be challenging. There will be a significant population transfer out of Gaza City as this operation is set to take place. Israel will need to be extremely careful about the buildings that continue to stand in Gaza City. Israel has apparently said that there will not be destruction of most of these large towers for fear of collateral damage. So that means that Israel plans to go house to house, building to building. That will put more soldiers in peril. You will see more urban warfare. This is complicated combat, John. And so I think the Israelis have to gird themselves for losses and injuries. I can imagine that the people of Israel will not be pleased with this, nor will the people of Gaza. The one thing that I did hear, though, which I think is quite interesting, is they will be moving the population slowly and steadily to an area called Mawasi, which is a coastal area almost right on the Mediterranean, west of Gaza City, I think southwest, if I'm not mistaken. And the goal will be to disarm all those who move to this area. That could include Hamas fighters. But as long as they don't have weapons and they're contained in a space that is controlled by Israel, what you could begin to see is the steady disarming of Hamas. And that appears to be the primary goal of such an operation.
Before we go to Lebanon and Syria, Australia is in the news this morning expelling an ambassador from Iran. And the allegation is that he was at the center of a network leading to violence against Jewish institutions and Israeli or Jews living in Australia. This is said to be, this is Financial Times reporting, the first expulsion of an ambassador since the Second War by Australia. Is this a significant blow to Iran? Does this in any way change the narrative that Israel's an aggressor?
Look, I don't think it changes the spat that has been taking place between Prime Minister Albanese and Prime Minister Netanyahu. The two men have squared off about the legitimacy of the Gaza war, the utility of Israel's continued fighting in Gaza. That said, I do believe that the protests that we've been watching and some of the actions ascribed to the public in Australia now need to be revisited. There needs to be a new analysis of what has transpired over the last year and a half to 2 years in Australia. We've seen pitched protests and anger on the streets, actions taken against the Jewish community, violence and intimidation. All of that, I think, now needs to be reassessed in light of this new information. The Australians have come out and openly seceded that this has happened. Perhaps it was intelligence provided by the Israelis, perhaps not. But one would hope, anyway, that right now these two leaders would come together in common cause, perhaps begin to understand that an end to the war in Gaza must include an end to Hamas. If Australia can get behind that, I think that would be a positive development, perhaps sparked by this recent news.
Iran's major army unconquered is Hezbollah in Lebanon. And there is talk that the Lebanese government is obliging would be a polite way to put it, Hezbollah to surrender weapons. Is that accurate or is that exaggeration?
No, it's not an exaggeration. And I think this could be the biggest story that is not really being reported right now. Let me just say there are two things happening in tandem. One is that the Lebanese government has started to disarm the so-called Palestinian refugee camps. These, of course, are not refugees any longer. These are the descendants of refugees from the 1948 conflict. But there are 12 such camps scattered across Lebanon. The Palestinian people are not particularly well loved in Lebanon, and no one truly cares about what happens in these camps. But the disarmament of these camps, where you have groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and others, they have maintained arms. They are armed to the teeth, in fact, in these camps. And the Lebanese government is moving ahead in one camp right now, Burj al Barajneh. This is the first camp that they plan to disarm. And if that's successful, they will continue on in dismantling other camps or other terrorist groups also maintain significant arsenals. This first camp is actually located in the heart of Dahiya. This is the stronghold of Hezbollah in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is hugely significant because if it is successful, then you will begin to see the Lebanese state move into areas controlled more directly by Hezbollah with the effort to dismantle the terrorist organization. John, Hezbollah has already lost something like 80% of its significant weapons. That's the result of Israel's military strikes. The last 20% plus small arms is the step that is needed right now for Lebanon to regain sovereignty. That is no small feat for a country that has lacked sovereignty since probably the 1970s. So this is a big, big moment, a generational opportunity.
Is there a number that makes sense to everybody about how many Hezbollah fighters there are overall?
My understanding is that there's somewhere between 10 and 20,000, which is not small, but what they lack right now is leadership. The commanders that were killed or injured in those beeper attacks and the walkie-talkies and the strikes carried out by Israel has thinned out the ranks of those commanders, which makes it much harder for those 10 or 20,000 fighters to be able to organize and operate.
We're going to Syria. Jonathan Schanzer, Executive Director, Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your Social Security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why, like you, he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.